This is the Faherty Podcast presented by Farmers Insurance. Now, I've got a question for you. Who am I channeling here? What? You cannot possibly be serious, Frank. That ball was on the line. This is chicken shit. All right, calm down. All right. During the 1970s, the 80s and 90s, John Patrick McEnroe Jr. was the iconic anti-hero of American sport and culture. Wherever he appeared, from Flushing Meadows to Roland Garros, Wimbledon, the broadcast booth, or on the couch with Johnny Carson, he was the main event. Outspoken, at times to an invective-filled double fault, but we always got his true, authentic self, brilliant and perhaps boorish. He was never boring.
I met John on the left coast in Malibu, California, where the sun is bright, the waves are tasty, and property values are obscenely high.
Johnny, thanks for having me here at the Malibu Racquet Club. It's a lovely spot, and I'm led to believe that you almost owned this.
Almost would be probably a good word, although the actual owner has a little bit more money from me than I do. Larry Ellison, the Oracle guy, decided to buy it. It was a mere bag of shells, as Ralph Cramden used to say.
How do you describe yourself?
I describe myself as someone who has been lucky that for whatever reason, someone up above wanted me to be a tennis player, I guess.
I think that you're the best commentator in any sport in the universe, and I've always loved listening to you.
Tell me more.
Yeah. I've always loved listening to you because it seems to me that, you know, occasionally there are these magical moments where you're not thinking about what you're going to say. It just comes out.
I don't know if that's totally accurate.
Yeah.
I think, unlike on the tennis court where things, you know, decisions are made a lot quicker, you can sort of be, as you know, be the backseat driver. The only thing that I really have a problem with is guys not giving the all that effort. You know, I mainly do the majors, and, you know, to me, to see a guy mail it in is just, it's hard to watch, and that right. I can't stand for. So I think more of the unfiltered stuff comes when I see that than anything else. But generally, I'm there to try to, you know, I want to see something great and get out of the way if possible.
Yeah. Well, you were never accused of quitting, that's for sure. You're accused of a lot of things, but not quitting. How much are you playing these days?
The body, you know, can't take it in the same way.
Right.
So I try to sort of go to the gym and try to get the body strong enough, maybe 3 days a week. And then 3 days a week, I'll try to be on the tennis court.
Right.
When I go out and play, I'd like to go on the seniors tour. They also have that in golf. Maybe we're two of the only sports that have that. We're lucky enough. I've been doing this for 25 years that they're actually still allegedly wanting to see me play occasionally and actually pay me for this. My whole life was about sort of, you know, my body and being able to do things hopefully exceptionally well, and that would take me to a place that eventually got me to winning a Wimbledon or being number one in the world. I've actually been pretty lucky. I've never had a surgery, and I can still go out and, you know, play a decent game of tennis for a set or so or an hour or so. So that's fun. It's fun to show the kids a little something still.
From 1979 to 1984, with his scruffy exterior, keen dexterity, and tabloid intensity, John was an anti-hero with a racket. His confrontations with Jimmy Connors and Bjorn Borg packed stadiums and transformed tennis into frenzy-inducing sport for the masses. He feasted on Grand Slams, winning four U.S. Open championships along with three Wimbledon titles, and finished number one in the world for four straight years. In my book, there will never be another like Johnny Mack.
That's pretty remarkable. Does it ever seem extraordinary to you?
It seemed remarkable until Federer and Nadal and Djokovic came along. I mean, Sampras sort of set this standard that I didn't think people would catch for a long time.
Right.
He got to 14 and he retired. He did a Joe DiMaggio. He won the U.S. Open, never played another match. You know, that's an unbelievable way to go out in a way. Although you must still feel like you can beat everyone if you just won the biggest one.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Along came these nobodies, Federer and Djokovic and Nadal, and not only were they, you know, amazing players, but they're great people, so you see what they've done. I'm like, seven is somewhere hopefully in the top 10. You know, I'm dropping in the all-time ranking list, it seems, each year or so. I think Djokovic is officially by me a couple years ago, and so that's a little depressing that I didn't, you know, maybe play more and some of the events like Australia, I didn't play the first 6 years of my career. I we don't want to get into the details, but I do try to look, you know, I think something that's important, being the father of six kids and trying to show, you know, your kids that you love life or appreciate what you've got. And I don't want to be dwelling on, well, I should have won the French, or I should have played the Australian, or I should have done this. So seven, you know, I feel was pretty damn good, but sometimes it's hard not to feel like it could have been better.
Many pro golfers fancy themselves as tennis jocks, but I had to give Matt Kuchar a few pointers at his club.
Oh, yes!
And I traveled to Spain, where Sergio was just a brat.
I was aiming at the left one.
Topping both of them, Jack loves tennis and holds tournaments in his backyard. Not surprisingly, some of tennis's best are pretty good golfers. John McEnroe is just what you'd expect.
I didn't listen!
Once the Mac, always the Mac.
I think the problem with golf, though, that it's too difficult. Okay, so I've seen, and people that I know actually, we go out and we try to play different courses and people quit. And you don't want people quitting the game when you're trying to attract new people.
And they're playing off unfeasible tees. You know, they want to play the tees that the pros do, and the game's just too hard for that.
Well, I mean, I think it's good that you have different spots for the tees. You know, the blue tees, the black, the championship, the this, the that. You want to, I'll go play with the big boys play. And then you quickly realize that's not, but that's not the part that's understandable. It's like the other stuff. But I'm hoping that both our sports are getting the message and hopefully doing some things to try to bring more people in. I think that would be hugely important for both our sports.
What hooked you on golf?
Golf more just, I don't know what it is. I can't explain it. You know, when I start to do it, I feel like I can't just be really mediocre. I've got to just get solid and not be embarrassing for betting a couple bucks and I'm the guy that's missing the easy putt or not doing my job. So once you get into it and you got that bug, you just can't get enough of it and you have hit two terribles, you go, that's it, I've had it, not playing anymore. And then you hit one, and all of a sudden, you hit a putt, it's a par three.
It brings you back?
You hit three terrible shots, but you hit a 40-foot putt, I'm back. it doesn't take much to get you back.
Yeah, you shot 81 this morning, so you can play.
I actually took a putting lesson recently because I realized it's embarrassing for a guy that made his living with his hands and his touch and his feel on a tennis court is a brick putter. It's not acceptable. So I have to, I finally, this morning, before your interview, was the best I ever putted in my life. I hit some one putts, made a couple putts, made a putt when it mattered. Can you believe that?
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, how much are you prepared to suffer to get better? That's the question.
Well, that's a good question. I don't necessarily enjoy suffering. I've been through some
suffering. You're used to it.
Well, I'm somewhat used to it because you have to do that in order to sort of get to the point you want to get when you're trying to be the best at something. But, I don't have to be the best at anything anymore. I try to be a good commentator. I love to get on the tennis court. I enjoy getting on a golf course. I play guitar. I love to play. This is my wife's band, Scandal, from the 80s. She says that I wrestle the guitar into submission, which is not exactly a big compliment. When I play golf and or, say, play guitar, it does make me appreciate what I was able to accomplish on the tennis court.
Well, golf's a funny game. Tell me a funny story about your game.
The first time I played the Michael Jordan Pro Celebrity event, they hooked me up with a guy by the name of Brett Hull, who's a hockey player, and he's a great guy, and he's also a heck of a hockey player.
Yeah.
So somehow, it had very little to do with me, we won the event. But the very last shot was an absolute pouring rain, and they just had to get it over with. There was a par three. I quickly put mine in the water, which was very embarrassing because it was the most amount of people that I'd ever hit a ball in front of. So that was despicable. But Brett hit, of course, his on the green and then proceeded to hit a 50-foot putt in the pouring rain for the win. So I should have said at that stage, look, this is amazing. But I decided to come back the next year because Michael Jordan's Michael Jordan. He raised a lot of money for a good cause, and they put me against Michael Jordan and Tom Brady, me and Brett Hull. And I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And we laid an absolute egg. Okay. Or should I say I laid an absolute egg. We were 4 over par the first nine in best ball.
Best ball?
Which is pretty tough to do, especially when you got Brett Hull on your side.
Well, Holly can hit it a little offline at times.
I think we were celebrating our win a little bit too much the night before.
Right.
Defending our title.
Right.
And these guys seemed like they were a little bit too serious about it.
Yeah.
But we did recover to get one under for the day. We went 5 under the back. No, I should say Brett went 5 under. So I just want to be part of a team, you know, and do something, you know, a fun time and not be like a liability.
In 1968, he was a scrawny kid from Queens. A decade later, he won the NCAA singles championship as a freshman at Stanford. Through 28 years as a pro, John racked up 77 ATP singles and 78 doubles championships. He proudly played on 5 winning U.S. Davis Cup teams. In 2016, John became the all-time leading winner on the ATP Champions Tour with 26 titles. Young, old, and in between, he could play.
Back in the 70s and 80s, did you and Jimmy Connors and Ilie Anastasi change tennis for the better, do you think?
We certainly raised some eyebrows and got some people railing about our behavior, but at the same time, getting more interested in the sport. And I think Connors, you know, he brought an intensity to it that was unmatched at that time. And he's like the Rafael Nadal of the 70s. I mean, the guy played like every point was the last point he'd ever play. And his story was interesting, and he had this me against the world thing. Nastasi was completely insane.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I was like, those guys are worse than I was. I mean, how am I the guy that's always the guy that's like, you just lost it completely. I mean, I learned a lot from those guys. I gotta give them credit. You know, it was sort of like the inmates running the asylum, which they didn't like. And I think they changed eventually a lot of rules that made it more boring personally. You know, certainly for a great period of time. And they wanted to stifle personality because we were, you know, they just couldn't handle us. But I'd like to think that all in all, we were good for the sport.
Yeah.
Depends who you ask, I guess.
Now, you guys, you had to have a healthy animosity, you know, back when you were playing against each other. You're friends now, right?
That would probably be a slight stretch, but we actually could be friendly with each other now. And golf, for example, that would be a perfect thing for us to, like, go do. He's, you know, always played, and he's was always a solid player. He played a lot more than I did, and I think he's 87 now, so it's a little tough for him. But that could be something we could do, and believe it or not, there's been talk, a couple mutual friends, that me and Yvonne getting out on the golf course.
Yvonne's a good player, right?
He is, well, unfortunately, I believe he is, yes. Yeah.
Rarely does anybody let loose with genuine emotion. There are exceptions, and we may owe the pleasure of those outbursts to Johnny Mack. Tiger is beloved for his fist-pumping victories. In Ryder Cup competition, Ian Poulter and Patrick Reed are loved and loathed for theirs. The emotion they create makes us feel alive. Okay, watching an entitled athlete undress a referee on live television might be fun, but it does challenge parents to balance the importance of individual expression against the need for societal decorum. Whatever that means. It's a teaching moment. Can you imagine John as a PGA Tour pro at Augusta? It's such a delightful thought, I dare not continue.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how bad were you?
A few very brief times, I was a 9.8 on the Richter scale.
You cannot be serious! That ball was on the line!
Most of the time, I was just, you know, sort of in a more or less what appeared to be a bad mood, but that was sort of to build up some intensity and, you know, try to get the edge any way I could. So it was probably ranging from 4 to 8. I came out sort of, you know, the whole day revolved around hopefully having that a couple hours where you'd have everything you needed to do the job. So I do wish I would have had the challenge system because I don't know if I do, I don't, because I wouldn't be probably sitting here doing this interview with you. I would have been more boring, but won like 20% more because I would have been able to focus my energies on what the hell I was doing instead of losing it all the time.
But you were so fun to watch. I mean, tennis these days is an endless bromance. There's no cursing or swearing or yelling or racket abuse. There's hardly anything.
We're heading towards golf, man. At this rate, it's just gonna be, you know, we might as well play in the same time.
Yeah.
That's another thing, you know, the mics, they used to be, seemingly like the mic I'm wearing right now on the tennis court. Every little breath I took, the word I took, you heard everything.
Bastards.
Now they go up to the.
That's right.
I mean, you're like, why didn't they protect me? My association or union protect the former number one player in the world when maybe he needed it a couple times? Because you remember the baseball, the managers, go up and start kicking dirt at them, and they'd be like this. And people loved that, but you didn't hear it. Now, if you actually heard the word, it may not have been quite, my little boy couldn't have handled that. Well, why in tennis did they have it then? Why did they subject me to this?
Serena has had that moment.
But I'm not a cheater.
Serena did.
Well, did she get a raw deal?
She's still, I mean, some other people have gotten away with that. Guys have gotten away with that. Who is she speaking about?
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I wonder why, believe it or not, I didn't work that day. ESPN didn't have me, I don't know why, they don't have me work the women anymore.
Mm.
And so I went golfing, believe it or not. I was on the golf course, and I all of a sudden was starting to get all these texts and calls. I'm like, why are people calling me? So I just decide, I'm looking at the time, I think, I'm gonna check the score of Serena's match, and she's losing. Maybe people are kind of thinking because she's losing. Then when all these flooding in, love to hear what you thought about the Serena match. Yeah. I'm like, of course, call the guy that lost it more than her. he can relate.
Yeah.
Serena was losing badly, she was frustrated.
You are the liar. You will never, ever, ever be on another court of mine as long as you live.
My opinion, I did things I regretted. She's gonna look back and regret that, because even though I think the umpire should have warned her, because I think it was totally personally out of line to take a game penalty in the finals of the US Open at 6-2, 4-3, not to get into details here.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, to me, you gotta give her the respect of like, look, you're losing it.
Mm.
People did that to me, believe it or not, sometimes. You're going over the edge, and, sometimes they did, which frustrated me.
Why do you qualify as the best female player in the world?
I guess it's apples and oranges. So we shouldn't get into, she's one of the greatest tennis players ever. For example, Annika Sörenstam, I believe she was one of the greatest female golfers ever.
I think she is.
What would she be ranked if she played on the men's tour? What would her ranking be?
No, just the physical disadvantages are just too great.
Women play in the women's tournaments, and the men's play in the men. Maybe that's why Bobby Riggs and the Billie Jean King thing was so interesting, that they actually played. Mm-hmm. And why people always ask me if I'll play Serena, when I never was the one that said I wanted to play Serena.
I'm
just defending myself when necessary. I always put my foot in my mouth one way or the other in this, but hopefully I didn't do it in this interview.
You and me both.
More Faherty will continue after a few words from our sponsor. Faherty is brought to you by Farmers Insurance. We know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
All right then, now back to the show.
Well, this is Rapid Fire with John McEnroe. Somebody start a clock. Grass, clay, or hard court?
Grass.
Curly or straight hair?
Curly.
Federer or Labor?
Labor.
Borg or Sampras?
Borg.
For bad behavior, you or Nick Kyrgios?
He's way worse than me.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, congratulations, Nick.
Okay.
Yeah. Favorite matchup in your day?
Borg.
Favorite matchup today?
Federer and Nadal.
Most heartbreaking loss? I know this.
84 French.
Yep.
Lendl.
Best part of your golf game?
Chipping.
Worst part of your golf game?
Putting.
Hmm. Super brat nickname, fair or unfair?
Unfair.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's rapid fire with John McEnroe. As always, Johnny, you win nothing. Who were your heroes in life and in tennis?
Tennis was Rod Laver. That's was my idol. Joe Namath was in his sort of peak years, a football player, New York Jets.
Broadway,
I was a kid,
Joe.
Grew up about 15 minutes from there. And Mickey Mantle, baseball player. So those were my three heroes growing up. And I didn't want to meet them necessarily. I mean, I've gotten to know Rod because of tennis, but Mickey, because you hear sort of the warts and sort of some of the things that maybe you don't want to know about some of these guys.
Were you and Rod Laver kindred spirits?
Not really, no. I think he's one of the world's nicest people and never has a harsh word about anyone, whereas I don't know if you'd paint me in that same picture. But I tried to, you know, squeeze balls and do everything I could to get an arm as big as his. I was the only number one player in history that has the same size arm.
Same size.
Even though I have a one-handed backhand. You know, I don't even use this arm.
Yeah.
This is worthless, except for doing this, throwing a toss-up. So that was sort of disappointing. But as far as our games were similar, you know, being able to sort of do everything with the ball, although he was the greatest.
How comfortable are you being idolized?
Well, I think that would be the ultimate compliment, right, if people idolize you. It doesn't happen so much anymore, I'm assuming.
There's a lot
of kids at my own academy, like some of my pros, I go speak to the kids. So they all gum around and they're looking. I'm like, all right, how many know who I am? Let's start with that. We have to say, this is the John McEnroe Tennis Academy. Who do you think this is? But fortunately, there's a fair amount of people that still appreciate what I do and appreciate what I did. You know, because the good part about maybe things not being as good for American tennis or the sport of tennis in general is that nostalgia does amazing. Every match I ever played was unbelievable.
Just give me a short impression of each of these players. Connors.
The greatest competitor I ever played against, no question. You know, I mean, he was like, Pete Rose was his twin brother.
Lendl.
Lendl was sort of that Ivan Drago guy, you know, from, you know, the communist country, Eastern European, but sort of like a machine. And so that was, and it had that, you know, look to him. That
Cyborg.
Exactly. So it was good to sort of that total contrast between me and him.
Nastasi
was just a complete and utter raving lunatic that just wanted to drive you crazy in the court. Unbelievably talented, one of the most talented guys that ever played tennis. And then after the match is over, he'd give you the shirt off his back.
Yeah.
Or anyone. He was just extremely generous and everyone liked him, but you wanted to strangle him while you were playing him.
Borg.
When I was 14 or 15, he played Wimbledon. And outside the locker room, there's like 250 screaming girls, like it was Beatlemania, the equivalent of that. This is like 1974. And that was the first day I go, I want to be a professional tennis player.
Yeah.
He had this aura about him, this look that was like this Viking, you know, god, you know, this beautiful looking guy with the great clothes and very strange, unusual way to play. You know, you hadn't seen anything like it before, the way he played the game. So it was, to me, it was the fire and ice. He's the only guy I never had a problem with.
Yeah.
On or off the court.
How did it affect you when he retired at the top of his game?
Well, he'd probably argue it wasn't at his top because I had just taken the number one ranking from him, but he was still the second ranked guy, so it was extremely disappointing. You know, it's like in the midst of your greatest rival, you bring each other to heights that you never imagined. I didn't imagine I'd get to. The guy's walking away when he's 25 years old. I'm like, you know, what the hell are you doing? So I think, you know, it did affect me for a couple of years. And I think, you know, ultimately, you know, I played him 14 times. Federer and Nadal played 50 times. Djokovic and Nadal played 45. I don't know the exact numbers, but way more than I played him.
I've been doing this professional sports thing for more than 40 years now. And I love to complain about it. All this adoration really chaps my ass. Don't you believe it? Not for a nanosecond. But for John, who hit iconic status at that early age, the answer is a bit more, well, it's complicated.
Did you appreciate it while it was happening to you, or only now, looking back?
I appreciated some of it, you know, and certainly some of it was absolutely amazing. The highs, you know, and the people you meet, the matches you win, the places you're at, the circumstances surrounding some of the tournament wins, getting to travel the world the way you are when you're a kid some of this is amazing. But you're also inevitably are always looking over your shoulder and putting a lot of pressure on yourself and trying to you win Wimbledon. We got to win another Wimbledon. You got to win third Wimbledon. You got to win this. You got to win everything. You know, my mom, who passed away last year, said to me when my first son was born, she said, are you going to retire? You know, I was 27 years old. I didn't plan on retiring. Mm. I just needed a break to like regroup, and I took, you know, eventually took 6 months off. And I go, Mom, I'm not gonna retire. Oh, thank God, you'll be able to buy your kids some diapers. I was like, Mom, how much money do I need in order for you to stop telling me that? Because I've already accomplished a lot. I don't need you to sort of keep, you gotta keep playing so you can have enough money to buy diapers for the kids. So there, you know, that perfectionist thing and never being satisfied, which propels you in a way to mm-hmm. get to where you are, ends up sabotaging you. But I work hard at trying to smooth out that, you know, it's like the rough edges, and, you know, it's difficult to do, but I think it's important to do, or else you're not going to be happy.
Your vocation? Is that what it is, tennis?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's your job. That's what a vocation is, right?
Well, you got to love it, and...
I mean, I think
feel like you were born to do it.
I think that for whatever reason, I believe that someone up above wanted me to do it. These circumstances, you know, as I was a kid, you know, where I started to play, and then I was sent to a legendary Davis Cup captain who had worked with the likes of Laver and Hode and Rose, all these greats, and then I was taught to play by this fantastic Mexican tennis player who had moved to Port Washington long. I mean, and all these things happened for me for a reason that allowed me to become this person. So, yeah, I do believe I was lucky to be able to sort of fall into it. My biggest thing that I envy about Roger Federer is that he actually looks like he loves playing out there. You know, win, lose, or draw to me, which I find astounding that you could, like, yeah. love it that much, you know? I mean, I love parts of it, but there's also part of it that's tearing you up.
Keep that thing away from me, you understand?
You seem to thrive on turning at least half the world against you, you know, whether
no,
it's or
that's not
crowds,
true.
Officials, no?
I'm not gonna let you finish that, because
that's
that
right.
isn't, no, I'm not a person that likes that. I sometimes put my foot in my mouth,
no,
and
I
probably did things that perhaps people didn't like, some of them, but I didn't do it. I wanted everyone on my side.
No, I didn't say you liked it.
Oh.
I said you thrived on it.
Oh, thrived on it. Well, I don't know if I, for a while, I was able to deal with it effectively. It wasn't something that I preferred. I would have preferred had people all been behind me and gotten it. You know, when Connors would play at the Open and convince the New Yorkers, who I think are a smart bunch, and I happen to think, you know, I'm a New Yorker and it's the greatest city in the world, and he's convinced that he's a New Yorker, and I grew up in Douglas and Queens. I'm like, what the hell are you doing? So it felt like people didn't get it at times, you know, didn't get me. And didn't, I thought it was sort of, some of it was deserved. I'm not saying it wasn't.
Yeah.
And believe me, I was criticized plenty.
Mm-hmm.
And other times it wasn't deserved, I believe. So fortunately for me, as it has been fortunate for you, I believe,
mm-hmm.
you've been able to sort of become this, you know, analyst and commentator. And it's allowed people to see you and me in a completely, or maybe people saw you that same way. I don't know you're playing.
No, you're right. You're
but
right.
They see you in a different way, and they've seen me. And that's allowed me to sort of blossom in a way as a human being.
3 decades ago, Johnny's razor-sharp game and on-court histrionics made him notorious. Today, his musings on players offer insight and controversy. His life and career have inspired movies, he's written books, and even hosted a talk show. John plays guitar with his rock star spouse, Patty Smythe, and he's fathered 6 children. On the golf course, John was part of the winning U.S. Celebrity Ryder Cup team in 2018.
Are you a perfectionist at every aspect of your life?
Pretty much everything, but I think that I've learned to sort of look, just try to realize that that's counterproductive, whether it's for everything.
Yeah, I mean, you need to quit golf for a start.
That'll probably happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. that may happen before this is aired.
If you could take a mulligan in life, what would it be?
A mulligan in life would be, you know, losing the match I lost at the French Open. I wanted to prove I was like the best ever. And if I had won that match, I sort of, at that time, I felt like I had taken tennis to another level. And I wanted to prove I could win on any surface, and I was only a few points away. So that was just a horrendous screw up.
Mulligans in life are presented by Farmers Insurance. We know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two.
You were right so often when you disagreed with an umpire or whatever. You were right often enough to where they named a camera after you.
That was, yeah, the Mac Cam. That's before the challenge system came into play. But they, I'm not sure they named it because I was right more often. I think there was because I complained more
often. But you had tremendous eyesight. It was
obvious. I did have good eyesight, but, you know, most tennis players have good eyesight, very good. You're used to seeing balls come at you at a pretty quick speed, so you pick it up quicker than some, you know, old guy that's half asleep.
Who's been in the champagne tent at lunchtime?
Yeah, you should have seen Wimbledon the first couple of years. Hey, buddy, wake up. There's a match playing being played here. You know, no, better yet, stay asleep. You might call and make a better call.
Well, your parents always looked fairly buttoned up, sitting in the stands watching you. How did they react to you throwing all the toys out of your cot?
You know, I was actually, believe it or not, you may find this hard to believe, but I was actually a well-behaved child. Yeah, it's sort of the cat got out of the bag when I went to Wimbledon in 1977. You know, the truth is that it opened these doors, and I had no idea. But I mean, I was, you know, pretty strict upbringing, and maybe it was just me wanting to just get out of that environment. I don't know. It wasn't like it was super strict, but they didn't have that much of a problem with me. I mean, I wish you could ask them, but I think that generally speaking, I was, you'd be surprised.
What do you think of parents sending their kids to academies, you know, like it's kind of trying to fast track them to, you know, professional
success?
Well,
I'm not big on that. I mean, I think that I wouldn't have made it had my parents done that. I wouldn't have wanted to be by myself at 10 years old or 12 or 14. Some kids, you know, a small percentage can thrive in that environment. Maybe it's what they need. My academy is different in the sense that I believe that it's actually a good idea if you go to school and play other sports.
Yes.
I played basketball in high school. I played soccer in high school. I, you know, took the same classes as everyone. I mean, you're forced to interact with people. It's a process you need as a kid. I know tennis, you're isolated. So a lot of parents homeschool their kids. Like, why are you doing that? That's a mistake. So my academy's there as an option. People go to Nick Bollettieri's or Chris Everett's and live in Florida or go to California and, you know, have a place where they can live and train. I mean, my son actually went to Bollettieri's 1 year. Mm-hmm. And about a month into school, I went and met the principal. And he said to me, I can assure you, Mr. McEnroe, that Sean's schoolwork won't get in the way of his tennis. And I'm like, isn't it the exact opposite? Because he's not going to be a professional tennis player. So, you know, that's not the message I think we want to be sending to 99.8% of the kids.
Your academy focuses on short and intense periods of training, right?
Well, I think the toughest thing for a kid is to develop that sort of mental fortitude and concentration that you need to, in order to execute at that highest level. So you got to start very small. You know, they think they're just out hitting balls. You got to be totally into it for 5 minutes. And then can you do it for 10 minutes? Can you keep that going for 15 minutes? It's like golf, you know, you can play one great hole and then you lose it for two holes. I mean, you got to eventually get to the stage where you're going to play a whole round of golf and there won't be very few breakdowns. And tennis is the same way. They don't get that that's the big part of it. The mental part of it. I mean, everyone at a certain level, if you're not an athlete, you're not going to be a professional tennis player. That's the end of the story. It even seems to be coming more like that in golf. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to be physically fit and hit it hard, long. After that, it boils down to the mental part.
Yeah.
And so you try to teach those skills for life skills, even if they're not end up being tennis skills.
Your grandfather emigrated to the U.S. from Ireland, right?
That's correct.
How do you identify with your Irish roots?
I didn't have a lot of relatives, or at least so I was told by my parents. But they certainly were very proud of the fact that they came, you know, Irish American heritage, my parents. I played Davis Cup against Ireland one time. And so they said, look, you have this one aunt, it's really important that you meet her because she's a relative of yours and you've got to go back to your roots. So I said, okay, you know, I'll do this. And I finally drove. It was like about an hour, hour and a half from the hotel and where we were playing the match. The first thing she said to me, goes, I like Borg more than I like you. I go, we're out of here.
That's nice.
I go, is this how our relatives from Ireland treat us? And then it's, come on, Johnny, have a beer, which I'd be okay to do. But, you know, beer number 27 is a little tough when you're playing a match the next day.
Yeah, I remember that. You know, you were quoted as saying, my parents are Irish-American, so there was a bit of yelling going on in my house, but it seemed normal.
Well, growing up in New York, it's a loud environment, and they're certainly loud. They loved each other, but their points, it's like I always kidded around, but it was sort of true. My dad would always say to me, you don't need to yell at those umpires. You know, you're better than that. Just go out and play. But it's the way he said it. You don't need to go yell at those umpires. You're better than that. Just play. So why, you know, big surprise.
Do as I say, not what I do.
It was like, go out there and be louder. That's why it was so weird when I played Wimbledon the first time. It was just so quiet, and they were so well-behaved.
Your dad had the bark, but your mom had the bite. Is that right?
It was a good combo. My mom, you know, watched out and made sure people weren't taking advantage of me. My dad was a lawyer, so he became my manager. He was the one always telling me I could do it. And pushing me, making me believe more. So they gave me this opportunity. I mean, I sort of liked other sports because I was around friends and not a lot of my friends were playing tennis. And then you go to places where it's just a whole new thing. But and I didn't get it for a while. But now sitting here talking to you, I get it a lot more.
Your life has been so packed. It's full of success and drama and some disappointment, but it's been a full and extraordinary life. What's left for John McEnroe?
Hopefully at some point, you know, I'll be able to handle the fact riding off into the sunset, not doing the same thing I'm doing, because I love what I'm doing. I see myself doing it for a handful of more years, but be able to go off and just do things I hadn't done, visit a few places I haven't been, sit on the beach and just be like, enjoy life to its fullest. Hopefully at some stage I'll be a grandfather and be able to appreciate things in a different way. But the important thing is not to sort of have to be dragged away from this. I'll be able to walk away with my head high.
Yeah. Well, I've wanted to do this for several years. Thank you so much for having me.
David, pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
No worries.
Thank you, buddy.
I could talk to Johnny Mac all day. He has opinions on everything and he'll share them because he doesn't really care what you think of what he thinks. Like so many of us, he's been playing his game for his whole life and he'll likely be swinging a racket and talking about it until he grabs his hat. John's an admitted perfectionist, but it's his mistakes that reveal his humanity in all of its flawed and twisted glory. I'm always on board for that, John. Thanks. Thanks for joining me, Fegarty fans. That's our show for tonight. You can catch me on Facebook, Instagram, and Fegartwit. You can also find more Fegarty podcasts presented by Farmers Insurance on Fegarty.com and your favorite podcast provider. Go to Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Art19, or Google Play. Search Fegarty and subscribe. If you love the show, why wouldn't you? Be sure to leave a rating.